From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And so what happens now that North Korea will send a delegation, including athletes, to the Winter Olympics in South Korea next month? The two countries announced the breakthrough at a meeting today at what's called the Panmunjom Peace Village at a neutral area within the demilitarized zone at the border. NPR's Elise Hu joins us from Seoul, where she was with other reporters watching a TV feed. So, Elise, the first meeting in 2 years, what did it look and feel like to you?
There was a lot of excitement in the air. Negotiators from both sides were really upbeat. They were earnest about trying to make a deal at the outset. To get to the meeting, the lead North Korean negotiator and his delegation actually just had to walk right over the border. No coat. They were flanked by other North Korean press, surrounded by a pool of cameras from South Korea as well. Once this delegation crossed the border, negotiators from the South and North sat at a long rectangular table facing one another for the duration of the discussions.
Huh. Now, give us some context here. First meeting between leaders in 2 years, but what's been North Korea's relationship to the Olympics?
North Korea has not participated in Winter Games for 8 years now. So this is going to be a significant step in North Korea kind of taking part in the Olympics once again. In 2000, for the Sydney Summer Games, South and North Korea actually marched together in the opening ceremony. So that was a significant point, showing unity. And that is what South Korea is inviting North Korea to do again, as South Korea is about to host the Winter Games in its resort town of Pyeongchang starting February 9th.
Wow. Is that going to be possible? All this, not just war of words, but missile tests on the part of North Korea. Is that going to be possible that they would march together? And how is the U.S. viewing that?
Well, North Korea is saying that it's going to consider this proposal by South Korea to walk together in the ceremonies. And North Korea's negotiator really emphasizes the fact that its primary security threat that it feels is not from South Korea, that its nuclear deterrent is not because of South Korea or China or neighbors in the region, that it feels the primary security threat is coming from the United States. And so that relationship, the relationship between the South and the North, both sides feel that can be mended, despite the fact that South Korea and the United States have a long-standing security alliance. Mm. So it is possible this is an opening. There will be more talks to come. But a lot was achieved in this one day of conversation between the South and North.
Did they bring up the military issues, the testing, nuclear program issues? Did that come up?
Kind of. South Korea did mention denuclearization, and North Korea did not respond well to that. The negotiators sat and did not react one way or the other as they listened to South Korea make that statement about denuclearization. But then, in a closing statement from the North Korean negotiator, he said that there was a friendly atmosphere in the meeting room, but that the South Korean media is making, quote, absurd reports that the meeting discussed denuclearization. He said that on the nuclear issue, that all of the weapons we possess, talking about North Korea here, are aimed at the United States, not aimed at our own people, referring to South Koreans.
Yeah. So, meantime, do we know what the North Korean Olympic program looks like? Do we know? I mean, we know there's a shortage of food in the country, but are there elite athletes who've been training for 8 years? And we hear they're sending cheerleaders. So what might we see?
There are. There's definitely a figure skating pair that's captured a lot of attention because this pair has already qualified for the games. Mm-hmm. And they have been seen by international press and have given some interviews as well. So we do expect that this pair, an 18-year-old and a 25-year-old, will participate as athletes in the games. It is also believed that Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea, is quite interested in winter sports. He grew up or attended school in Switzerland in his high school years, and so he is a big fan of skiing. And so we do expect North Korea's delegation to be a wide range of folks, not just athletes, but high-level visitors, government officials. North Korea says it will also be bringing a Taekwondo exhibition team and a cheering squad. So there will be many North Koreans to see and be amongst for those that are actually going to be in the Olympic Village.
We've actually been quite fascinated by the North Korean ice skaters. I don't know if I have this correct. Is it Ryum Tae Ok and Kim Ju Sik?
Yeah, it's hard to say. It would be Ryeon Tae Ok and Kim Ju Sik. Yeah.
Okay, we've got to get used to those names. That's Elise Hu in Seoul. Elise, thank you so much.
You bet.
Well, the stock market is surging with the Dow above 25,000, a number that was almost unthinkable not that long ago. Let's take a closer look at some of the winners and losers in this hot market. Diane Swank is chief economist at Grant Thornton. And Diane, we're seeing some eye-popping numbers here, but what companies are really leading the surge?
Well, what we saw is a whole rotation. We saw a big surge in financial firms for a while. Then we saw it move into technology. And now it's sort of going back into firms that were the dogs of last year. And so you're seeing firms come back like General Electric, that I use that as an example because it's one firm that was really hit hard. And all of a sudden that and IBM started doing really well because people thought, well, listen, nobody's been buying them, so we might as well buy those. What I think what's really key about the market is there's sort of a sense of euphoria that's reminiscent of the late 1990s. I've come to start saying, you know, we're partying like it's 1999, Prince, but we're in a 21st century economy. And as you remember, in 1999, that didn't end well. There's times when the market is not the U.S. economy and it's not leading the U.S. economy. In fact, gets ahead of the U.S. economy. And my concern is that's where we are today. I don't prefer a correction. I would prefer the market to move sideways and allow the economy to catch up. I fear that may take a while, but that would be my preference.
So are you concerned about things being overheated right now? And if that's the case, what broader effect could it have on the economy as a whole? Because, of course, many people are celebrating the Dow at above 25,000 and saying, hey, this is great news for every American.
Well, it's not great news for every American. Only a little over 50% of Americans hold any kind of stock. That's way down from the peaks that we saw prior to the crisis that were almost two-thirds of Americans. It's not all of Americans,
well,
number
one. Yeah, to that point, I mean, we were also looking at some numbers that said that the top 20% of Americans own more than 90% of all stocks.
There you go. It's very concentrated. But, you know, I think it's great. The stock market's great. It's great the U.S. economy is still expanding. Those are what we need, longevity. What you fear is overheating and get ahead of yourself. Today, there's a report out that we actually are seeing fewer people hedge their bets on the stock market, which means a kind of confidence. It's like driving without a seatbelt. They're so confident the market will keep going up, they're flying without a safety net. And I think this is also very concerning, is those investors investing in the stock market getting ahead of the underlying fundamentals. You know, things like waiters and my hairdresser telling me to buy Bitcoin or telling me to buy Apple. It really is sort of stunning and, again, overly euphoric, almost irrational exuberance, which Shiller actually quoted that phrase to Greenspan and uttered it before it became famous. And it's important to remember because that was back in 1996 that phrase was first heard, and we saw the markets go up well above that for many years afterwards. You can't time market volatility. It's a very difficult time to pick winners and losers. We know the oil industry has won dramatically from deregulation. It's won from lifting on drilling restraints. It's won on the tax cuts as well. So that's an industry that everyone's excited about. That said, once oil production ramps back up in the U.S. and cuts aren't as great in places like Saudi Arabia, which still acts like a spigot on prices, all of a sudden you have prices lower and the industry is doing worse 6 months down the road. So it's a very dynamic environment. And I think that's something that people have not taken into account.
Yeah. You know, I hear your note of caution, though, in the midst of this dynamic environment. But I wonder if there is still some other good news here. I'm still taken by your example of GE, which really took a huge beating last year. And if investors are turning back to GE and doing some value harvesting, I guess, there, I mean, isn't that kind of good news that they're still seeing that there's here's a company that's worth investing in? It's such a big one for the country.
There's always good news that there's hope in the future. And, you know, this exuberance we're seeing, it is a positive thing. You just don't want to get ahead of it. And that's, you know, we haven't really lost our herd mentality. We've seen it many times. The good news is that the market gains we're seeing are not highly levered like they were, say, in 1929. So
right.
When we worry about the Shiller Index and Bob Shiller and his valuations, one of the things he cautions is, well, if it crashes, it will be more like a bust from the tech bubble or a burst like in 1987. there wasn't as much leverage in both of those times, so it didn't take the whole economy down, or it did into a minor recession, not a major recession.
So the contagion would be contained.
Exactly. That, and it's you know, it'd be more paper losses,
right.
And those people who got the most from it would also maybe not be spending as much on, you know, yachts and things like that. So we won't worry about that all that much. But I do think in a broader sense that we do have to sort of be cautious. And it just worries me that people are so euphoric and there's a disconnect between the momentum in the stock market and the momentum in the economy. Now, to some extent, earnings will show up because we just gave a big tax cut. But that's a one-time effect. What we're doing is we're sort of getting a sugar high today at the expense of growth later in the cycle because we're taking on a lot of debt to do it. And historically, debt-driven growth has ended poorly. And even though the stock market isn't leveraged, we are leveraged as a nation. So as good as these tax cuts look today, there's a trade-off over just a 3 to 4 year horizon where debt gets much higher and the cost of that debt and the cost of higher interest rates, particularly for lower income and middle income households, becomes more burdensome.
Well, Diane Swonk is chief economist at Grant Thornton. Your wisdom is so very valued here at Here and Now. Thank you so much, Diane.
Thank you.
The Trump administration is making good on its promise to reevaluate the country's immigration policies, including what's known as temporary protected status, or TPS. In November, the administration ended the temporary protection for Nicaraguans. It also delayed a decision about the future of TPS for Hondurans and said that the program for Haitians will expire in July of next year. Well, yesterday, immigrants from El Salvador, the largest group of immigrants in the country with TPS, were told they have 18 months to find another legal status or leave the United States. From member station WBUR, Shannon Dooling has reaction from Massachusetts.
When Irma Flores and her two children applied for temporary protected status, or TPS, back in 2001, she knew it was a temporary means of living and working legally in the U.S. But after 17 years, her life here feels permanent.
It doesn't matter what are the reasons you came to this country, but I think we have been demonstrating to the government we are hard workers.
Flores, who lives in Haverhill, Massachusetts, sent her children to college. Her daughter bought a home, and Flores now has three grandchildren who are U.S. citizens. Renewing her TPS every 18 months or so just became a formality, or so she thought. Flores says the Trump administration's decision is devastating, but she's ready to fight in order to stay here.
We have been contributing to the United States. We pay taxes. And this is just crazy because I don't think people will leave. And that is an issue for this country as well.
TPS was conceived as a humanitarian program. It's designed to provide a safe haven for people whose home countries are hit hard by natural disasters or war. Salvadorans were granted TPS in 2001 after back-to-back earthquakes leveled the country. The temporary protection allows people to live and work in the U.S. without fear of deportation. But now that the Trump administration will end the program for El Salvador on September 9th, 2019, that all changes, and TPS holders who have no other avenue for legal residency will be vulnerable to removal.
In my mother's case, if she just decides to leave, she's leaving behind an entire life, and her kids are here.
19-year-old Elmer Vivas Portillo's mother, who is from El Salvador, has been living in the U.S. with TPS since 2001. Vivas Portillo and his younger brother are both U.S.-born citizens and live in Cambridge, Massachusetts. The sophomore at Harvard University says he expects plenty of difficult conversations among his family in the coming months.
It's absolutely going to require, you know, having a conversation, all of us together, and saying, well, we're going to explore other options, but, you know, that September 2019 deadline rolls around. What are we going to do?
And it's not just families asking this question. Businesses are also facing uncertain futures. $400 million of the state's annual GDP could be lost, according to an estimate from the Center for American Progress. And Ava Malona of the Massachusetts Immigrant and Refugee Advocacy Coalition says losing the 6,000 Salvadoran TPS holders would be a blow to the state's workforce.
Salvadorians, by far, are the largest group of TPS holders. They have established strong ties and deep connections to their local communities. They own businesses. have mortgages, pay taxes.
Locally, we're going to continue to fight for our friends and our families and our children and our community.
In Somerville, Massachusetts, Mayor Joseph Curtatone made it clear that he will stand by TPS holders in his so-called sanctuary city.
The level of advocacy and activism to support the people we care about, we love, will be unprecedented.
Curtatone called on Congress to legislate a permanent solution for TPS holders. Senior administration officials say El Salvador has largely recovered from the destruction caused by the 2001 earthquakes. When asked about the epidemic of gang violence that plagues the country, the administration says that was not a factor in their decision. Homeland Security officials suggest TPS holders use the next 18 months to explore legal options for staying in the U.S. or prepare to return to El Salvador. For Here and Now, I'm Shannon Dooling.
Let's turn to the conflict in Syria now, where the Syrian military is claiming that Israel targeted outposts near Damascus with missile strikes early this morning. Syria also says its Air Force hit one of the Israeli planes and shot down several of the missiles. Israel has not commented specifically on today's accusation. Sebastian Usher is the BBC's Arab Affairs correspondent. He joins us from London. And Sebastian, whether or not Israel confirms today's missile strikes, we know it has carried out attacks inside Syria during this civil war. So why has Israel done that?
Yes, it's carried out quite a large number of attacks. Last year, the Air Force chief in Israel said there'd been at least 100 such airstrikes during the 5 years of a conflict up to that point. I mean, Israel normally doesn't make any comment, as you say. They haven't made a comment about today, except the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, was asked the question about the airstrikes. And though he didn't confirm directly that Israel was responsible, he said, and in fact, he answered your question in a way. He said that it's a long-standing policy of Israel, essentially, to ensure two things. One, that high-quality weapons aren't able to be transferred from Syrian territory to Hezbollah, the Lebanese militia that's been a key part of the factions fighting for President Assad and keeping him in power. And even more urgently, I think, for Israel recently, that Iran, which backs Hezbollah but also has its own other militias in the country, again fighting for President Assad, shouldn't be allowed under any circumstances to establish a military base in Syria. As I say, Benjamin Netanyahu was quite explicit about this, which is essentially the Israeli policy on the Syrian conflict.
I see. So the Syrian conflict, though, is so incredibly complicated. Forgive me if I ask you kind of some basic questions here, because Israel engaging militarily for the purpose of protecting itself for the reasons you just mentioned is one thing. But is it also engaging militarily in support of the rebels who are fighting Assad? Because that's an entirely different set of circumstances.
It's accused of that. When it carries out attacks like this, I mean, there have been people from various outlets which are connected to President Assad or the Iranians or the Russians, who, of course, are the other major backer for the Syrian president, saying what Israel is accomplishing here is essentially helping the Islamic State group. Any attack on the Syrian government is playing into their hands. That's sort of nonsensical, really, at this stage when ISIS has been so much pushed on the back foot. I think, though, to be rational about this, as I think the Israelis have tried to be throughout, is they haven't had any direct interest in fighting on the ground in any way in the Syrian conflict. In a sense, for a lot of the conflict, they've been relatively happy to see President Assad and the rebel groups against him, and even the Iranians to some extent, very much occupied in their own battles, which Israel hasn't needed to get involved in. I mean, Israel's main concern is about the strength, particularly of Hezbollah, as I was saying, and they have to some extent been strengthened by what's been going on in the conflict militarily, in terms of experience, in terms now of the way that there are more direct routes to get arms to them. And this idea that the Iranians are spreading their influence and they're coming closer to the border with Israel, potentially. So Israel wants it to be made very clear that in any final settlement of this appalling war, the Iranians won't be left with a base, essentially, in the Syrian conflict, and it won't be the country that essentially calls the shots on whatever power is left in place in Syria. All of those things are much more likely than they were 2 or 3 years ago. Also, I mean, Israel would be concerned and has been concerned about any jihadist groups, ISIS or otherwise, getting closer to their northern border, the northern border with Israel. And there have been some operations in the past few months which seem to have been targeting that more than anything else. But I don't think, as things stand at the moment, that's a major threat. They've dealt with Hezbollah firing missiles over from the Lebanese side of the border for years and haven't really been that troubled.
Mm. Now, Sebastian, you used the term appalling in terms of the Syrian conflict, and I think that is right. Perhaps even an understatement. Hundreds of thousands of dead, millions displaced. I mean, we can talk about the different players, the different nations involved in the Syrian conflict, but what has the cost really been for Syria and the region overall?
I mean, it's had an incalculable effect, both in terms of human misery, but in terms of the complete shattering, really. I'm not that the status quo that existed in the Middle East before was anything to be particularly proud of or write home about, but it shattered that. And what we're seeing now, as the conflict perhaps enters an end game, but one that could go on for a long, long time, is an attempt now to shape that future, to look at the way that Syria will be reassembled. So all the countries that have been involved, and we talk about the regional players, but then also the ones which come from outside the region, the US being a major one, obviously Russia being another, and how they will see their interests in the country and what they will do to pursue those interests.
Well, Sebastian Usher is the BBC's Arab Affairs correspondent, speaking to us today from London. Sebastian, thank you so very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I'm Robin Young, co-host with Jeremy Hobson of Here and Now from NPR and WBUR. We cover the day's most essential news with analysis and context so you know the why and the what's next, plus authors, artists, people making a difference. It's a fast-paced snapshot of the world every day. Listen to Here and Now on NPR One or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Well, it's only January, but maybe some folks were already daydreaming about what kind of tax refund they may be getting come spring. Now, the conventional wisdom says that the extra money may go to consumer items, a new couch or a television, perhaps. But a new study from JP Morgan Chase Institute finds that a lot of that money actually goes to something much more serious: your health. Ali Velshi is MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. He's also co-host of Velshi and Rule. Hi there, Ali.
Hey, Magna.
So this study found that spending on healthcare spikes 60% in the week after Americans get their tax refund. It's a huge number.
Yeah, it's very telling about the fact that healthcare and its affordability remain major, major problems. I mean, we, in popular culture, we think of the tax refund as a windfall. It's not really a windfall. It's your money anyway that has been overpaid to the government. But the idea that most people who get this refund actually end up using it to cover healthcare expenses, it should be worrisome, and it increases, the percentage increases the lower your income. So if you're at the higher end of the income scale, only about 11% of people use their refund toward healthcare things. But this upwards of 60% is for people who are in the lower end of the income scale. It's a big problem.
And I'm seeing that the study finds that, to your point about income inequality, that people with only about $500 in their checking accounts increase their health spending by 220% in that time period. But that also means that perhaps they're waiting to get that health care until
right.
they have the money. Isn't that a problem?
Well, that's the bigger problem, right? It's not that you're paying down something that you bought on a credit card, for instance. One of the things that the study points out is that most of the money is being used on debit cards or electronic payments, which means people might actually be waiting, as you say, to get that treatment as opposed to paying down treatment they've already had. Now, from a preventative health, you know, one of the things, Magna, that we've been talking about for a year now is why the health care system in America costs so much more than other countries while achieving similar outcomes. And one of it is that Americans don't engage in preventative health care as much as they do. Our insurance system doesn't support it, but nor does this. If you can't afford health care, then you're getting what you can get when you have the money to get it, and you're not engaging in the preventative health care, which could end up preventing things like heart attacks, diabetes, and similar illnesses.
So, I mean, I take your point that, you know, maybe thinking about health care the same way we ought to think about retirement, like just constantly caring for it,
yes.
Is the way to do it. But on the other hand, I mean, a lot of folks are probably saying, well, with my, to your point, with my deductibles and et cetera, I can't pay for it until I get the money back from the government.
Right. So two distinct problems. One is healthcare is too expensive in America and lots of people can't get it. So that's a problem that in theory the Affordable Care Act was supposed to fix. And it went some distance to fixing it, but it was an imperfect deal that is now on life support, if you will. The other issue is we don't have any infrastructure like IRAs and 401ks for healthcare. So while we should think about it that way, you should in your best earning years be putting aside money for when you have that, the infrastructure is not as robust as it is. It's not obvious to most people how you do that, and it's certainly not obvious to lower income people who don't have the extra money anyway. So this is the kind of things, you know, these are the kind of things that when we're thinking about a just society, we have to start to think about, because again, the least among us are the ones most affected
just
by
have
it.
A couple quick seconds, Ali, but you don't think health savings account would be a good analogy there?
Well, they're good because they're sort of triple tax-free. The money's invested pre-tax. There's no tax on the interest or when the money's taken out. It is not utilized as well as it should be. That's it's one of the bright stars in the story, but it's not enough.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent and co-host of Velshi and Rule. Thank you so much.
Bye.
So how did the homeless fare during the recent frigid weather in parts of the country? The Department of Housing and Urban Development says the number of homeless people in the U.S. is up for the first time since 2010. In a few minutes, we'll meet an Illinois man who decided to help at least some of them. But first, Nan Roman, president and CEO of the National Alliance to End Homelessness. Nan, what did you see nationwide?
Well, generally speaking, I think people that provide services to homeless people, that run the shelters and so forth, as well as most cities, really struggle to make sure that they have a place for people to come in, that they're doing outreach on the streets to find people who may not know that it's going to get so cold, that they have call-in emergency numbers so that citizens can alert the police or helpers to make sure that people get in. But we do have a lot of people who are unsheltered in our country. 35% of people who are homeless are not sheltered. We have about 550,000 homeless people, but only about 275,000 emergency beds. So this is something that causes issues when we have these kind of serious cold snaps.
What percentage of that is the homeless who don't want to come inside? They have some mental issues or a real fear of a shelter? And what is, you know, families with single moms maybe who can't find rooms?
It's generally much more single individuals, not so much families. And I think it's not very many people who really don't want to come inside. The issue tends more often to be that there are barriers to their coming inside. So they have to have forms of ID, or they have to meet certain criteria to either get into shelters or stay in shelters. This is often because the shelters aren't resourced or don't have staff that can really provide services.
Well, this is something we're about to hear about from our next guest, that the idea that shelters have to screen for legal issues, but also for what they're capable of handling. So people who may be intoxicated, people who may have health issues, often the people who need it the most, they can't take.
Shelters really do need to lower their barriers, and we need to support them to do that so that there is a bed that's appropriate for every person. We just cannot be leaving people on the streets when it's cold or when it's not cold.
But those are the issues. What happens when civilians try to house the homeless? We're going to talk to a man in a moment. City officials shut down his effort. Do you see that elsewhere in the country?
I haven't heard of that elsewhere in the country, but I do think there's, you know, this really is a personal issue. It comes up with giving people money on the street or inviting them into your home. And honestly, I feel that this is largely something that we need to leave up to individuals. I don't know all the details of the case that you're talking about. But if people feel compelled to help folks because they feel they're in trouble outside, I don't think we should be stopping them doing that.
Yeah. Why is there an uptick in the homeless population? Is it because of the disasters we've had recently? The economy's doing great. Joblessness is down. Why the uptick?
Homelessness is really driven by the cost of affordable housing primarily, and housing costs are way up relative to incomes for poor people. And that seems to be driving increased homelessness, particularly on the West Coast. There are a lot of places, about half of states saw decreases. Many communities saw decreases in homelessness, but big cities saw increases in particularly West Coast cities.
Yeah, we know about that. In Northern California, after the fires, there was homelessness before and more now. Nan Roman, President and CEO of the National Alliance to End Homelessness. Nan, thank you.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me.
And now to Greg Schiller, the Elgin, Illinois homeless activist who invited 10 to 15 homeless people to stay in his girlfriend's basement several nights this winter with sleeping bags, a portable toilet outside. Schiller argued it was just a slumber party with friends who happened to be homeless, but officials shut it down because of public safety concerns, and they pointed to the legal licensed shelters run by the local group Public Action to Deliver Shelter, or PADS. And Greg Schiller joins us. Greg, we understand you had a meeting with the city yesterday. What happened?
Yeah, yesterday afternoon, I sat down with the entire command staff of the Elgin Police Department and the assistant city manager, and we forged a partnership. They do realize that there is a gap, and subsequently, because of this gap, people are being left out on the street, and they want me to work with them toward that change.
Well, that sounds pretty productive. And this is something...
It's something that I've been trying to push through for going on 6 years.
Well, let's explain. You've been involved with the homeless. You co-founded an organization, Matthew 25:40. I'm sure a lot of people can repeat after me. Whatever you do for the least among us of our brothers and sisters, you do for me. And
correct.
So this group runs a shelter out of the First United Methodist Church in Elgin. I understand you parted ways with the group and have been doing this. Why? Because there are nights that that shelter wasn't open?
Yeah, we have two main homeless shelters, and then we have a crisis center that's for typically for women and children. The main shelter, and I believe it's because of their funding and their insurance, they've got some restrictions that will prohibit people from entry. One of those restrictions is if they're currently intoxicated, they can't get in. There's residency issues. If you can't prove local residency, you can't get in. There's if you're unmedicated, mentally ill. There's a whole list of issues that can keep an individual from getting into that shelter.
Well, and we should say that it's licensed, and sometimes these are licensing prohibitions, you know, to avoid legal issues. Right, right. But tell me more about what compels you here, and Matthew 25:40, one of my favorite passages.
Well, it's, you know, I named the ministry that I founded, you know, based on that passage, because this is where Jesus gives us our instructions of how we're supposed to be toward one another, especially toward those in need. And he also says that, you know, whatever you didn't do for the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you also did not do for me. You know, he's showing us how we're supposed to be here in this world. And I do take that very seriously.
Well, and it's commendable, but do you understand the city's point of view when they were concerned?
Oh, sure,
you
sure.
know, yeah. I mean, they
you know, I understand the city's point of view. I understand the building codes and the need for them. You know, I'm not trying to thumb my nose up at the law or anything. I saw an emergency situation, and you know, these people, they're not all healthy, and I don't want anyone to freeze to death.
Yeah. Well, and you know, city officials were worried about possible carbon monoxide poisoning because of ventilation, inadequate light, exits that were concerning.
And actually, the whole carbon monoxide and all that, we've got detectors in the basement. They tested them and worked. We have fire extinguishers. The big issue was the egress, that there wasn't a viable second exit out of the basement. And I understand that. I mean, if there was a fire, it could have been an issue.
Well, and you've said that because of your concerns as well about that, you would stay up with these guys and watch movies if you treated it like
I supervised all night.
Yeah.
I did.
So going forward, are you going to be able to continue to have these, quote, slumber parties, or is the city going to be more determined to pick up the homeless? What's the resolution?
Well, right now, PADS has said that they're easing some of the restrictions, and what the police department wants me to do is when I identify anyone who believes that they cannot get into PADS, to give them a call, and they will transport them to PADS and see if they can get in. And if they cannot, they will open up their lobby. That's the interim solution. We were approached by a local business owner who wants to give us a 4,500 square foot building in which to run a shelter that's not going to turn anyone away, that has a a comprehensive program just to make sure that, you know, nobody's left out in the cold. And I'm actually going to look at that building today.
Oh, it's quite, once you are in, you have to be in, you know, deeply in if you commit to this issue.
I'm 100% committed to this. There is a need.
Yeah. Let me ask you something. Full disclosure, we had a homeless person generations past in my family. These are people who often, their hygiene isn't great. They have drinking issues. Sometimes they can't even hold their own urine, you know. How do you get past that? How do you do that?
Baby steps. Meet them where they're at and stay with them. Develop a relationship with them, a real relationship. Take a vested interest in that individual and walk them, you know, however slowly they need to go toward recovery.
That's Greg Schiller, who turned his basement in Elton, Illinois, into what he called a slumber party room. The city saw it as an illegal shelter, but looks like they have been working together now. Greg, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Naloxone has become a powerful tool in the battle to save lives of people who overdose on opioids. It quickly reverses the effects of an overdose and can restore normal respiration to someone who's stopped breathing. Naloxone is sold under different brand names, the most recognizable of which is Narcan. And in Philadelphia, paramedics revive thousands of people each year using Narcan. But after they come around, more and more drug users are refusing an ambulance ride to the hospital. And as reporter Joel Wolfram discovered, that's making it even tougher to get them into treatment.
The gravel road behind Genevieve Gear's home in Philadelphia's Kensington neighborhood has become a popular place to inject heroin. It's an area that struggles with a large population of homeless drug users. Not long ago, Gear saw a man laying on the ground outside her back gate. A woman was leaning over him in a panic.
He was turning kind of purple. She was screaming. Then the ambulance pulled up, and the guys got out of the ambulance. They jabbed him with the Narcan. And then, he took a great big deep breath and looked stunned.
When the man came around, Gear says the paramedics asked him a list of questions, including whether he wanted to seek addiction treatment and get checked out at the hospital. He said no, and soon his rescuers got in the ambulance and drove away. Not long after they left, Gear says the woman he was with started rifling through a purse.
She pulls out needles, and then they moved a little further down the street, and then they shot up again.
Philadelphia paramedics say 16% of the patients they revive with Narcan refuse a ride to the hospital. That number has tripled over the past 2 years. The head of emergency medical services at the Philly Fire Department, Jeremiah Laster, says paramedics try to get everyone who's overdosed into that ambulance. But they're not required to transport patients who are alert and oriented after getting Narcan, and Laster says it can be difficult to persuade them to take the ride.
It's a difficult thing, but you can't force the care on people.
Laster says these patients need monitoring to make sure they don't fall back into an overdose when the Narcan wears off. Skipping the ambulance ride could also mean missing an opportunity to access treatment. Hospitals throughout Philadelphia and the state are working on a way to make emergency rooms better entry points, adding detox beds and offering medications that help people get off heroin. But if overdose patients don't get to the ER, they're less likely to get help.
It's a near-death experience, and you really want to get these people the help they need.
During the first half of 2017, Philadelphia paramedics administered Narcan more than 3,000 times, close to twice as many as the same period the year before. That means there's more awareness among drug users of the withdrawal symptoms that follow a hit with Narcan and how many hours they might be stuck in the ER. A lot of people paramedics are saving these days already know the drill.
I've had 3 overdoses in my lifetime.
Lewis Brown was revived by paramedics each time. He's now in recovery and does outreach work for the harm reduction nonprofit Prevention Point Philadelphia. But the first time Brown OD'd, he was living out in an abandoned building.
My overdose actually saved my life. I had walking pneumonia, and I didn't want to go to the hospital. And the paramedics was like, you got a lot more going on. Like, you should go to the hospital.
He listened to them and spent 4 months in a hospital bed recovering from the pneumonia. But after the second and third overdoses, Brown said no to the ambulance. The withdrawal symptoms were too much to bear.
Diarrhea, throwing up, nose snotting, cold shakes, you know, you don't want to feel that. So instead of going to the hospital and getting more treatment, I went and got more heroin, you know. The same thing that just almost took my life, I ran right back and got again.
Prevention Point's Associate Executive Director, Silvana Mazzella, says it's important to tell overdose survivors that the withdrawal symptoms are a temporary effect of the Narcan and that it's not safe to use again. Prevention Point often monitors drug users they can't convince to get more medical care to make sure the overdose doesn't relapse when the Narcan wears off. She says the reality is that right now, many hospitals don't do that much more for them.
You might get offered treatment. That treatment will likely not be available right away. Someone is in withdrawal after that reversal, so if they are waiting several hours for that treatment assessment, it's unlikely that someone's going to stay.
Hospitals are working on ways to get that treatment started faster. Mazzella says that until that happens, overdose survivors who have gone to the ER before are more likely to walk away from paramedics. To address this, Philadelphia recently announced it's creating an overdose response unit that will travel with paramedics to the scene. When drug users turn down the ambulance ride, a social worker and recovery specialist on the team will talk to them about treatment options and how to prevent future overdoses. Jeremiah Laster, head of the city's paramedic service, says it could help to have a different messenger convey that information.
Every time 911 is called, people are not happy to see us. They're not happy to see us. You inject somebody with Narcan and now they're yelling and screaming at you because you just blew their high. I mean, that's the reality of this drug and this epidemic.
The city says the new teams will start responding to calls this summer. For Here and Now, I'm Joel Wolfram in Philadelphia.
And Joel's story comes to us from member station WHYY. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.